Weekday afternoons starting this Friday on BBC Radio 3 from 2 o'clock.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news from Vaughan Savage.
The Australian government has intervened to try to end the industrial dispute at the national airline Qantas, which has led to the company grounding all its flights. 600 flights have been cancelled across the world. Four of them have been due to leave from Heathrow. The members of 17 Commonwealth delegations who've been attending a summit in Perth are among the 70,000 passengers affected. The Australian Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, said the government had taken the rare step of calling an emergency arbitration hearing to end the strike. The government's making a big increase in the amount that courts can deduct from people's weekly benefits to pay for fines imposed for criminal behaviour. From 2013, courts will be able to take up to £25 a week instead of the current minimum of £5. David Cameron said the system had been sending out too many of the wrong signals. Reports from Syria say there's been more heavy gunfire in the central city of Homs, where security forces are trying to crush an anti-government uprising. Yesterday, activists said nearly 40 people were killed when troops opened fire on protesters. A number of people have been killed in a car bomb attack on a military convoy in the Afghan capital. Three civilians and a policeman are among those known to have died. Residents of the Thai capital, Bangkok, are bracing themselves for high tide later today as floodwaters continue to cause havoc in the city. Thousands of people have already fled as many parts of the northern suburbs succumbed to the floods. A 16-year-old girl has died after a hang gliding crash in Derbyshire. The glider crashed during a training flight at Ashbourne yesterday. The teenager died from her injuries in hospital shortly afterwards. The Labour Party candidate, Michael D. Higgins, has been elected the 9th President of the Irish Republic. The 70-year-old poet received around 40% of the total votes. Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness came third. The weather, the wind and rain in Scotland and Northern Ireland will spread across most areas today, turning heavy at times. The BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one.
Time now for the Early Music Show, which is presented today by Catherine Bott, after a little music which is a couple of months early.
The opening of Schütz's Christmas Story, Andrew Parrott conducting that recording of his own edition. In today's Early Music Show, a huge subject. You know what a media kerfuffle there always is whenever someone discovers 14 bars of scribble in Mozart's or Beethoven's handwriting? How excited everyone gets, arguing the toss about its importance to musicology, or more often, how it's actually old hat. Everyone's always known about that silly old fragment. Well, I reckon the early music movement should get a bit more credit for rehabilitating, in some cases excavating, the entire output of neglected composers. What was life like before we'd all heard the devotions of Hildegard of Bingen or Monteverdi's Vespers? Mind you, in the case of some of the finest repertoire, it isn't just a question of discovering the manuscript in an attic and flogging it at auction prior to the pioneering recording. Serious, considered scholarship, imagination, and above all, taste are needed to flesh out repertoire where not all the orchestral parts have survived and there never was a full score, for example. One man whose detective work has brought a great deal of old music to our delighted new ears is conductor Andrew Parrott. His new recording of Bach's Music to Mourn Prince Leopold is just out, more on that later, and he reconstructed that opening piece of Schütz. So when we met in a studio recently, I began by asking him what he'd had to do to complete the music we've just heard.
It was recorded a long time ago, if I can remember. It was relatively easy, it has to be said. All that survives for that movement is the vocal parts and the bass line, the figured bass line. So really you know what the harmony is, that you have a clear structure. It is equally clear that there were instrumental parts, and it's understandable why they got lost, because parts of the piece of the Christmas Story as a whole were printed, and other parts were available on hire from Schütz, and they circulated in manuscript, and bits got lost. So in that case, in the case of the introduction, there are no instrumental parts surviving, so one had to supply them.
Andrew Parrott, making this reconstruction business sound, if not easy, certainly pretty straightforward. But then he's a formidable scholar. I've never really done any work like this, but as a singer, I do give a great deal of thought to the embellishment of Baroque music. My ornamentation has got to be helpful to the expression of the words and appropriate to the style of the music. When I mentioned this, Andrew generously added singers to the list of reconstructors too.
If you think of it, you've got a piece of notation, you're singing any phrase. What is that? You are reconstructing the composer's imagined music from these dots on a page, from a code. That is a reconstruction. It's not the conventional meaning of the word. But what I'm saying is that practically everything we do as performers, and even as scholars, has to have some imagination or educated guesswork involved in it. And there are endless degrees, endless ways you can apply this principle. So the word reconstruction, you can argue it out of existence as you can with authenticity, because if you don't like what people are doing, you can say, well, that's not authentic. But if you use it in a vaguer sense, it's all the same thing. We're trying to understand the past and a particular composer's mind.
One of the more pleasurable tasks for the director of an early music instrumental ensemble is deciding what should play where, when the composer may not have been very specific. In the Florentine Intermedi, for example, those epic entertainments for Renaissance wedding receptions, the world is surely your oyster. When he tackled the Intermedi, how had Andrew Parrott gone about assembling a Renaissance big band?
What I find an interesting challenge is to try and understand what the options were then. So with the scoring, you know that these instruments would have played that sort of part or in that sort of range and that sort of pitch. So you build up an idea. And with the Intermedi that you mentioned, we have all the music surviving, well, practically all, and that's wonderful. It was printed, most of it. We have elaborate descriptions, detailed descriptions, not least of the scoring. We know that there were 12 lutes and five sackbuts and goodness knows what else. But we don't know how those five sackbuts and 12 lutes fitted to the music. What did the lutes play? Did they play a single line? Did they play chords? What did they have in front of them? Did they memorise it? So many questions arise even when you've got all that information.
And there was a sort of iconography, this is entirely the wrong word, but I cannot think of a better one, like the iconography of Renaissance art, where gestures and positioning of people and the direction from left to right on the flight into Egypt really means something. Yes. Instruments and their use actually had emotional and spiritual and educational significance.
Absolutely. The layers of connotation and tradition and the changing traditions, of course, are, well, I think a lot of people sort of feel intimidated by the whole subject, and I sort of understand that, but I find it eternally fascinating, really, to try and discover more, because you can realise that one composer in one corner of Venice in exactly the same year does something quite different from another composer maybe in the same corner of Venice living next door. But it's always informative to find out these little details. By themselves, they may be unimportant, but cumulatively, they can really open up sort of doors that you didn't know were there.
Thank you.
the sound of doors opening up and letting us into a Medici wedding of several centuries ago. My guest on today's early music show, Andrew Parrott, directing the Taverner Consort and Players in music from the Florentine Intermedi. The recording sessions provided, among other things, a wonderful opportunity for lute players to assemble in unprecedented numbers. I wonder if anyone came up with a collective noun for such a gathering. One of the best-loved full-scale works in the whole of the early music repertoire is also one that arouses cheerful argument wherever two or three musicologists are gathered together, Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610. The reconstruction of liturgical music, tackling its composer's original purpose in writing it, throws up some fascinating questions. Andrew Parrott.
There are lots of specific questions, but the broader question is about reconstructing a liturgical event into which that music may or may not fit. I think that's probably where remaining controversy is, really, because I do not perform the piece as it's printed from page one right through to the end. I reorder some movements for good reasons, I hope. I also add some music by other composers for good reasons, I hope, and in the right place. But more particularly, I think that such a collection of music, whether it's intended as a work or an anthology, that's a big question, would never have been performed without plain chant, without a context. You'd never sit down and say, let's have a concert of the music that he's printed. And if you did, you would not automatically do it in order. That's a very, very modern approach to the dots that you have in front of you, the printed music. So then people will say, OK, but we don't know what event it was performed at. That's really not the point, or rather that is missing the point as far as I can see it in quite a big way, because that music could complete or bits of it have fitted into endless numbers of liturgical events. It could never, or most of it would never have been heard outside a liturgical event. So what do? I choose the major Marian feast, because it's a collection of Marian music, and that gives it a framework, an architecture, from which I think I've learned more about the piece, because you hear the way Monteverdi interacts with the plain chant, not a specific plain chant necessarily, but generally plain chant. And indeed, that is what binds all the major movements together, all the psalms and the hymn and the Magnificat. They're all based on chant. So to have, as it were, real chant, unadorned chant, going into Monteverdi's adornment in different ways of plain chant just makes a whole lot of sense, whether it's right or not, or whether it's a particular reconstruction, I mean a precise reconstruction of a particular event or not, it gives it the sort of context in which it would have been heard, and the only sort of context in which it would have been heard.
You have chosen as the movement that everyone will know, the Laudate Pueri. How does that connect with chant?
Well, it's just something that we will hear in a moment. The very first phrase is chant, and it's an unadorned chant. One voice sets it out, and then it expands and it grows into more parts and all the rest of it. But when you hear that preceded by the antiphon, you approach it differently, and you hear the connection between that liturgical framework and Monteverdi's embellishment of it. You just, it's as audible as you can get.
Oh.
the antiphon and psalm Laudate Pueri from Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610 in Andrew Parrott's performing edition. On that recording, he's conducting the Taverner Consort and Players. Their latest recording is of music by Bach, some of which listeners will think they know already. The music on this disc was originally played and sung at the funeral of Bach's loyal and musical patron, Prince Leopold of Anhalt-Köthen, in 1728. I asked Andrew Parrott what he'd had to go on with this project.
What survives is a libretto. A libretto by Bach's colleague Picander from Leipzig, who provided also the libretto for the Matthew Passion, for example. And that's a relevant example. It's been known for a long time, since the 1850s or 60s, well, it's been recognised that the rhythm, the verse patterns of all the arias and some of the choruses, it's rather familiar. It's the same as pieces from the Matthew Passion and from the other wonderful funeral piece, Trauer Oder, for the Electress of Saxony. There was a lot of discussion about which came first, but we know that the Matthew Passion existed and the Trauer Oder existed when Prince Leopold died in 1728, and that's the starting point for this exploration.
Andrew Parrott, whose reconstruction of some of Bach's most thoughtful and profound funeral music has been made largely from its surviving libretto. Bach took great care with this sad task because he'd always been close to his young patron, Prince Leopold, who was only 33 when he died. The prince not only liked Bach's music, he studied the viola da gamba. So as a posthumous compliment, Bach made sure to include a gamba obbligato in the next music we'll hear.
There is a great compliment to him in the very first piece that one would have heard, if I'm right, which is a gamba solo played by Abel, the father of the English Abel, as it were, taken from the Matthew Passion, the Komm süßes Kreuz, as we knew it, Lass Leopold dich nicht begraben, Leopold, do not let yourself be buried. That is, as it were, emblematic of Prince Leopold, who is thought to have studied viol with Abel. He suddenly plays string instruments and not only loved music and new music, but played music.
So at the very least, this is a really thoughtful
work. Would one ever think of Bach not being thoughtful?
No, we should never be surprised, but it is something to rejoice in.
Thank you.
Thomas Melioranza and gamba player Suzanne Heinrich in the lament, "Leopold, do not let yourself be buried." A vain plea, sadly. And if you've only just tuned in, that's the same music as the aria "Come, Sweetest Cross" from the St. Matthew Passion, tenderly recycled by Bach with words in honour of his royal patron. As Andrew said, looking at the texts of those two works side by side, it all makes perfect sense. And it's the same with this alto aria from the St. Matthew. The opening lines, bus und roi, knirscht das Sündenherz entzwei. Work equally well in the Trauermusik, same notes, same scansion, as weh und ach, kränkt die Seelen tausendfach. And here is the funerary aria, sung by Claire Wilkinson. Thank you. Claire Wilkinson with the Taverner Players, directed by Andrew Parrott, in an aria that began life in Bach's St. Matthew Passion and then did double duty to mark another death. I asked Andrew Parrott why the score and parts from Prince Leopold's funeral music hadn't survived.
Because, very probably, he didn't create a score. Why create... I mean, copying out a full score of all that, when you've got the music there, is demonstrably not what he did on other comparable occasions. He would just use the same score with a different text added or abbreviated in added in abbreviated form for himself. Of course, the singers would have to have special copies made with the new text, but otherwise the instrumental parts are identical.
That's why there was no need to have a score.
Yeah.
So given that there is obviously a need to commemorate Prince Leopold again and to commemorate the deed that Bach did in making his funeral so beautiful, what is the real purpose for us today, do you think?
I think for most musicians, anything Bach does is of interest. And this is, in a way, it's an oddball. I don't deny it. There's no direct parallel for it. But because of our knowledge of the two parent pieces, we have to get through that barrier. But I think really understanding the context, reconstructing in our minds, not necessarily in absolute detail, but the context of these two services and the darkened church and the bells summoning people and the story of the slow procession from the court chapel where the embalmed body had lain through the winter months, all that. When you got that in your mind, you then listen to it differently and you understand what Bach's doing. He's not just peddling hit tunes from the Matthew Passion and the other pieces just to show off or because he's lazy. It is very carefully thought out.
Well, we're going to hear one whole section of this four-part work at the end of the programme. But before that, let's just return for a moment to a chorus from its other parent work, the Trauer Ode for the Electress of Saxony. Music from Bach's funerary ode for the Electress of Saxony, reused in his Trauermusik. Andrew Parrott's reconstruction, from the libretto, of Bach's Trauermusik for Prince Leopold conforms to all the words I used at the top of the programme. It's a piece of serious, considered scholarship, carried out with imagination and, above all, taste. My thanks to him for coming in to talk about it. We're going to end, as I said, with a substantial excerpt, with Andrew directing the Taverner Consort and Players, and soloists Emily Van Ivera, Claire Wilkinson, Charles Daniels and Thomas Melioranza. But before we do, here's a small celebration of the intensely human satisfaction to be found in musicology, even at my level. Andrew has contributed an excellent article on this reconstruction to the scholarly journal Early Music, and when I was reading it to prepare for our meeting, I found out something very touching. Another blissful discovery, because I had never given it sufficient thought, was that the soprano soloist at the funeral of Prince Leopold was Anna Magdalena Bach.
Yes, indeed. And it's very interesting. People have books say, yes, she was paid to go and sing there. They don't comment on that. They don't seem to recognise that this is significant because it's in a church service. It's in a Calvinist church service, because it was a Calvinist choir, not even Lutheran. A woman singing all these arias, and not only the arias, but of course the choruses, that were written for the male establishments in Leipzig. Bach doesn't alter anything or anything, but Anna Magdalena Bach was a really highly paid member of the court musical establishment under Leopold. In fact, she had a salary which was, it wasn't as much as Bach's, but it was twice as much as anybody else's. She was a young soprano, and she obviously earned her keep and must have sacrificed her career for that this marriage to Bach, and been a real musical accomplice and aide to him. Everyone knows she was a wonderful copyist and very, very thorough, but, you know, she must have been a darn good singer as well.
Warum eine?
One of the four parts from the music to mourn Prince Leopold by J.S. Bach, from the first recording and construction of the work by Andrew Parrott, who directed the Taverner Consort and Players. Well, today's Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott, and in tomorrow's programme, Lucy Skeeping will be presenting highlights from a concert given by Ensemble Caprice at the 2011 Lufthansa Festival. That's at the same time, just after the 1 o'clock news.
Leonardo, artist, engineer, showman.
If the painter wishes to see monstrous things, he can be lord and creator thereof. If he wishes to depict creatures or devils in hell, he only has to unlock his imagination.
BBC Radio 3's Sunday feature uncovers a lesser-known aspect of Leonardo da Vinci, his pageants and parades.
You have somebody who I believe had what I call a four-dimensional mind. He could visualise the time sequence of the event itself that the audience are watching, but also the process.
With excerpts from Leonardo's notebooks and vivid eyewitness accounts, Leonardo's biographer Charles Nicol explores yet another amazing aspect of this Renaissance man. This week's Radio 3 Sunday feature, starting at 7:45.
And now the Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert, first broadcast live from Wigmore Hall in London last Monday. It was presented by Sarah Walker.
A pair of early 20th century masterpieces make up today's lunchtime concert, given by violinist Veronica Eberle and pianist Shai Wozner, both connected to Radio 3's New Generation Artists scheme. They'll be rounding off with an early work by Bartok, his first violin sonata, and before that, something more autumnal, the violin sonata by Debussy. It was written in 1916, close to the end of his life, and was intended to be part of a series of six. It ended up being the third and final one. Many listeners have noticed a classical coolness about this piece, very beautiful but quite severe compared to some of Debussy's earlier work. And it's true that he was very ill when he wrote it, but that's not the reason for the new style. It was more a case of Debussy taking inspiration from earlier French composers like Rameau. In fact, the title page of his late sonatas was designed to look like an 18th century score, and the composer described himself as Claude Debussy, musicien français. So to play Debussy's violin sonata in G minor, here comes violinist Veronica Eberle and pianist Shai Wozner.